Good afternoon, brethren. Good to see everybody today. You know, in a very short time, roughly about 2 months from now, the Passover will be upon us. And as the spring holy day season approaches, we tend to look a little more carefully into our lives. And the reality is, of course, we should be looking every day into our lives, but we spend more time, more effort this time of year considering what God the Father and Jesus Christ has done for us. We have to make sure that we are doing those things that are pleasing to God as well. Let's start off going to a very familiar passage in 1 Corinthians 11. 1 Corinthians 11, we will start in verse 26. 1 Corinthians 11, starting in verse 26, where Paul was telling the Corinthians a little earlier in the chapter about what happened on the Passover, and telling them what they needed to do, and us as well, and to prepare to partake of the Passover. 1 Corinthians 11 and verse 26. For as often as you eat this bread and drink this cup, you shall proclaim the Lord's death till he comes. Therefore, whoever eats this bread or drinks this cup of the Lord in an unworthy manner will be guilty of the body and the blood of the Lord. But let a man examine himself, and so let him eat of the bread and drink of the cup. For he who eats and drinks in an unworthy manner eats and drinks judgment to himself, not discerning the Lord's body. For this reason many are weak and sick among you, and many sleep. For if we would judge ourselves, we would not be judged. So we're told to examine ourselves before we take of the Passover, so we don't take it in an unworthy manner. What does it mean to examine? What does the word examine mean? The word examine here translated, Strong's number 1381, dokimazo, and it means to test, and by implication to approve, to discern, or to examine. Now, Mounce's expository dictionary says the word, it also quote, it carries the idea of critical examination of something to determine genuineness. Is it genuine? It's a close examination to see, such as, is a rock in your hand true gold or is it fool's gold? How would you know? You have to examine it to see if it's genuine. That's what we have to do, brethren, as Christians. We must examine our lives to see if we are truly a genuine Christian. In verse 31, it tells us we are to judge ourselves. That's part of the examination process, to look at ourselves and make judgments on ourselves. We're supposed to do this before we take of the Passover. Of course, we are supposed to take of the Passover, not get discouraged when we look at ourselves, but we are to take it Passover after that. So what do we examine in our life? You know, there's many ways to approach this when you think about this subject, but I want to get to the very core of our being. Today, I want to talk about examining the self. The title today is simply that, examining the self. Examining the self. You can see we need to, you know, you can look at this or you could look at that in our life, but it gets down to the self. Let's face it, you and I are very selfish creatures, and we know we are. We're very selfish creatures. None of us are exempted, not a one of us, and that is something you and I must overcome, that selfishness that we have. We're still carnal, and instinctively, we do want our own way, don't we? That is just the reality of life. We're still carnal. So today I have five areas in our life that we need to examine. All of these five points begin with the word self. Now, as you read all these five, we go through these five, you may not be a 10, like the worst, but you may be a 1. But it doesn't matter. We all have to overcome in these areas, and we have to examine ourselves because we all wrestle with our selfish human nature. So let's start out with point number one. Point number one, self-righteousness. Self-righteousness. All of us have this problem to one extent or another. Before we were called by God and granted repentance, we probably thought something like this. Well, you know, I'm I'm really not that bad, you know? I'm really not. I don't steal. I haven't killed anybody. I don't cheat on my mate. Really, I'm pretty good. I'm not like, you know, oh, so-and-so down the road or Uncle Joe. You know, I'm really a pretty good guy. That's the way we think of ourselves. Let's go to Luke chapter 18. Luke chapter 18, we'll start in verse 9. Luke 18, this is a very familiar parable that Christ gave to a particular group of people. They thought of themselves this way as well. They thought they were pretty good. Luke chapter 18, starting in verse 9. We ask the question, why did Jesus Christ give this parable? Verse 9. Also, he spoke this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and despised others. It's hard to be righteous and despise others, isn't it? But they were sure that they were righteous. Verse 10. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee, the other a tax collector. The Pharisee stood and prayed thus with himself, God, I thank you that I am not like other men, extortioners, unjust, idolaters, or even as this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I give tithes of all I possess. And the tax collector, standing afar off, would not so much as raise his eyes to heaven, but he beat his breast, saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. I tell you, this man went down to his house justified rather than the other. For everyone who exalts himself will be humbled, and he who humbles himself will be exalted. Now look at the Pharisee. What standard did the Pharisee use to compare himself? What standard did he use to make the judgment? Did he compare himself to God and God's word? Or did he compare himself to someone else? Again, look at me. I'm not as bad as that guy. You know, I'm doing something. I'm tithing. I'm doing something like that. He was promoting his own self-righteousness, wasn't he? 2 Corinthians chapter 10. 2 Corinthians chapter 10, we'll read one verse, verse 12. Paul warned us not to do that, because there were some who were doing that very same thing. They were using their own standards with each other to measure their righteousness. 2 Corinthians chapter 10 and verse 12. 2 Corinthians 10, verse 12. We dare not class ourselves or compare ourselves with those who commend themselves. But they, measuring themselves by themselves and comparing themselves among themselves, are not wise. They were used in a standard that comparing themselves to other men. Well, I'm not as bad as such and such, and I'm really a pretty good guy. Just don't ask the wife. But, you know, I'm a pretty good guy, they're saying, you know, compared to this other person. You know, I'm in pretty good shape spiritually. I don't have the problem he is. I'm not a drunk or whatever the case may be. I'm doing a lot better than them. But we're not supposed to be comparing ourselves to other people, are we? We're not supposed to be comparing ourselves to mere men. We are to be comparing ourselves to Jesus Christ. An example that he set. Isaiah chapter 64. Let's go back to Isaiah chapter 64. And we will read verse 6. And again, before we were converted and coming into the church and God granted us repentance, we probably felt this way. I mean, you can listen to people talk and this is the way they feel. Well, you know, I'm doing pretty good. You know, remember the old thing, I'm okay, you're okay? Well, we're not bad, you know, compared to everybody else. Isaiah chapter 64, verse 6. God, through the prophet of Isaiah, he tells us something about our own righteousness, and it's not very good. Isaiah chapter 64, verse 6. But we are all like an unclean thing. All our righteousness is like filthy rags. We all fade as a leaf, and our iniquities, like the wind, has driven us away. God says our righteousness, our self-righteousness, it's just like a filthy rag. Our own self-righteousness is not something we want to hold on to. God doesn't have very good or very high opinion of our own righteousness, does he? He compares it to a filthy and dirty rag. It'd be like taking a filthy rag out of the laundry basket. It's just covered with mud after you get out of the shower, dry yourself off with. Filthy. Not clean. Isaiah chapter 65, just the next verse. Read verses 2 through 5. God here is talking about trying to reach the nation of Israel, but they're rebellious. Let's read what the nation of Israel, what they thought of themselves. Isaiah 65, verse 2. God says, I've stretched out my hands all day long to a rebellious people who walk in a way that is not good, according to their own thoughts, a people who provoke me to anger continually to my face, who sacrifice in the gardens, who burn incense on the altars of brick, who sit among the graves and spend the night in the tombs, who eat swine's flesh and the broth of abominable things is in their vessel, who say, keep to yourself, don't come near me, for I am holier than you. These are smoke in my nostrils and a fire that burns all the day. Verse 2, it says, they walk in their own thoughts. The New Living Translation says, they walk in their own crooked schemes. I can read verse 5 from the New Living Translation. Quote, yet they say to each other, don't come too close, or you'll defile me. I am holier than you. These people are stench to my nostrils and an acrid smell that never goes away. They were telling the other people, you know, I am so righteous that you can't even come close to me. You know, the dirt from your unrighteousness will come on me. And if you read, what were they doing? They were eating swine's flesh. They were doing all this. But they and them considered themselves so righteous. That means that the other people, they looked at them as a wretched and a vile person. Remember the Pharisee and the publican? What'd he say? I thank you, God, that I'm not like him. It's the same thing. It's that self-righteous attitude. God hates self-righteousness. Remember, it's like filthy rags. And as we approach the Passover, as we consider these things, you and I have to take the time to look at ourselves to make sure that we don't miss the mark on this particular point. It's easy to do. Let's go to point number two. Point number two is self-justification. Self-justification. This problem comes so easy, doesn't it? We catch ourselves in this quite often. You know, it's really easy to see self-justification when you're bringing kids up. It kind of goes like this. Johnny, why'd you hit your sister? She made me do it. Well, how did she make you do it? She stuck out her tongue and made a face at me. That's why I hit her. See? Easy, right? When you have kids, you can see what happens. He justified his action because she made me do it. And self-justification really started with Adam and Eve, if you think about it. Remember when God asked Adam, he said, Adam, who told you were naked? Who told you were naked? Who told you, did you eat of the tree that I commanded you not to eat? What did Adam say? You're right. I'm sorry. Shouldn't have done it. You know, shouldn't have. Nope, he didn't, did he? Remember what he said? He protected himself. He said, the woman that you gave to be with me, she gave it to me. And I ate it. Not only did he not take the blame for what he did, he blamed God. First he blamed Eve, of course, you know, that woman. But he also said, that woman, what? That you gave to me. That you gave to me. I didn't ask for her. So God, really, it's kind of your fault because you gave that woman to me. He took absolutely no credit when it comes to doing wrong. It's all somebody else's fault. When God asked Eve, what did Eve say? That serpent, by the way, which you created, he deceived me. He deceived me. So both of them really blamed someone else, didn't they? They didn't. They self-justified. It's not my fault. The serpent deceived me. And from the beginning of mankind, it's been the same. Man justifies the self. And guess what? We've all done it ourselves, haven't we? Think about it. You ever been pulled over for speeding? You ever been pulled over for some other situation? What's the first thing you do? Officer, I didn't realize I speeding. And I realize you might not have, okay. But all these excuses, if you've ever read excuses, the people that come up with these excuses of why it happened. You know, it's just automatic. Somebody catches us doing something wrong, like, well, it's not my fault. Such and such did it. I got pulled over probably a couple years ago, and I didn't realize the speed had dropped from 40 to 30 as you popped over the hill. And all I could do is say, well, I apologize. I didn't know it dropped. And they gave me a warning ticket, thankfully. But, you know, I really didn't. You can say, oh, that's an excuse, and I'm sure they've heard it a million times. I'm a basketball official. Been for 30-some years. I hear every excuse under the book. It wasn't me. I didn't touch the guy. You know, your hand slapped him down, put him on the ground. And they'll say, it wasn't me. I didn't do a thing. Again, we do justify ourselves, don't we? Exodus chapter 32. Exodus chapter 32. We'll see a few scriptures that show that happened. Exodus 32. And we'll start in verse 21. If you remember back in Exodus 32, Moses was up on the Mount Sinai receiving the instruction from God. But he was gone a long time. And Aaron was left there to take charge. Finally, the people decided that something must have happened to Moses. He'd been gone so long. They asked that an idol or god be made to lead them. So Aaron made the golden calf. What did Aaron say when Moses asked him about it? Exodus 32, starting in verse 21. And Moses said to Aaron, what did this people do to you that you brought such a great sin upon them? It's like, did they blackmail you, Aaron? What did they do to you? So Aaron said, do not let the anger of my Lord become hot. You know the people, they are set on evil. For they said to me, make us gods that shall go out before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us out of the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him. And I said to them, whoever has any gold, let him break it off. So they gave it to me, and I cast it in the fire, and this calf popped out. It's just like, wow, it's amazing, isn't it? They just said, take the gold, and they started a fire, and we just chunked it in there. And this calf just popped out. Did he take responsibility? We know that he actually did it, the shaping of it. Or did he justify his actions? He justified his own actions, didn't he? Not only that, but he go back a little, what'd he say? It's the people's fault. Remember, they're always set on evil. Aaron didn't take responsibility, did he, at all? 1 Samuel chapter 13. And I'm not, you know, we read these things and we think about that, but we do the same thing. 1 Samuel chapter 13, we'll start in verse 8. 1 Samuel 13, verse 8. And that is something as we approach the Passover. In fact, at all times, we should look in ourselves. How do we do? Do we do the same thing? Make excuses? Justify ourselves? 1 Samuel chapter 13, we'll start in verse 8. Saul was told here to go to wait for Samuel to come to offer the sacrifice. He was told to wait 7 days. Saul got impatient, decided to do it anyway, himself. 1 Samuel 13, verse 8. Then he had waited 7 days according to the time set by Samuel, but Samuel did not come to Gilgal, and the people were scattered from him. So Saul said, bring a burnt offering and peace offerings here to me, and he offered the burnt offerings. Now it happened as soon as he had finished presenting the burnt offering that Samuel came, and Saul went out to greet him and to meet him and to greet him. And Samuel said, what have you done? Saul said, when I saw the people were scattered from me and that you did not come within the days appointed, and that the Philistines gathered together at Mishmash, then I said, the Philistines will come down on me at Gilgal, and I have not made supplication to the Lord. Therefore I felt compelled to offer a burnt offering. Samuel said to Saul, you've done foolishly. You've not kept the commandment of the Lord your God, which he commanded you, for now the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel. But now your kingdom shall not continue. The Lord has sought for himself a man after his own heart, and the Lord had commanded him to be commander over his people. Because you have not kept what the Lord commanded you. You know, Saul had no authority to offer up that sacrifice. He made an excuse. He goes, well, you know, they were coming, and I felt compelled. I just had to do something. He justified himself. Chapter 15, here, the same in 1 Samuel, chapter 15. We'll start in verse 13. Another thing that Saul did, he was told to go destroy the Amalekites. Again, these are very familiar stories. But we think about what they've done in the justification that Saul gave. Chapter 15, starting in verse 13. Then Samuel went to Saul, and Saul said to him, blessed are you of the Lord, I perform the commandment of the Lord. And Samuel said, then what is this bleating of sheep in my ears and the lowing of oxen which I hear? And Saul said, they brought them from the Amalekites, for the people spared the best of the sheep and oxen, and to sacrifice to the Lord your God, and the rest we've utterly destroyed. Then Samuel said to Saul, be quiet. I have to tell you what the Lord said to me last night. And he said to him, speak on. So Samuel said, when you were little in your own eyes, were you not the head of the tribes of Israel? And did not the Lord anoint you king over Israel? Now the Lord has sent you on a mission and said, go and utterly destroy the sinners, the Amalekites, and fight against them until they're consumed. Why then did you not obey the voice of the Lord? Why did you swoop down on the spoil and do evil in the sight of the Lord? Saul said to Samuel, but I have obeyed the voice of the Lord and gone into the mission which the Lord sent me and brought back Agag, the king of Amalek, and I've utterly destroyed the Amalekites. But the people took of the plunder and the sheep and the oxen and the best things that should be utterly destroyed to sacrifice to the Lord your God in Gilgal. So Samuel said, as the Lord great delight in burnt offerings and sacrifice, as in obeying the voice of the Lord, better to obey than sacrifice, and to heed than the fat of rams. For rebellion is a sin of witchcraft, and stubbornness as iniquity and idolatry. Because you've rejected the word of the Lord, he has also rejected you from being king. Saul justified again his disobedience by saying the people did it. The people want to do it. They're the ones who wanted to keep the best of the animals to sacrifice to God. It's the people's fault. But really, it was something else. And read verse 24 and you find out the real story. Then Saul said to Samuel, I've sinned. I've transgressed the commandment of the Lord in your words because I feared the people and obeyed their voice. He feared what the people thought of him more than he feared what God had told him to do. Looking good to the people was more important to him. He was playing politics is what he was doing. That's the reality of it. He justified his actions rather than doing what God had told him to do. Because the people. And the end result, of course, we know, was Saul was rejected and eventually died in battle as king of Israel. Let's go to Matthew chapter 21. Matthew chapter 21. We'll restart in verse 23. If you read there and you think about Saul and things he did because of the people, you think about the things that have happened this week and the politics and the people, the things you do, and it's the same. People will do these things and claim, well, it's the people. It's the people rather than doing what's right. Matthew chapter 21, starting in verse 27. It's quite often the Pharisees and the other religious leaders, they confronted Jesus Christ about what he taught. In this case, they questioned his authority. And they had to justify their own result, as we will read. Matthew chapter 21, starting in verse 23. Now when he came into the temple, the chief priests and the elders of the people confronted him as he was teaching and said, by what authority are you doing these things? And who gave you this authority? Jesus answered and said to them, I will also ask you one thing, which if you tell me, I likewise will tell you by what authority I do these things. The question was, the baptism of John, where was it from? From heaven or from men? And they reasoned among themselves, saying, if we say from heaven, then he will say, why then did you not believe him? But if we say from men, we fear the multitude, for all count John as a prophet. So they answered Jesus and said, we do not know. And he said to them, neither will I tell you by what authority I do these things. Again, they reasoned among themselves, justified their answers, trying to figure out how to exactly answer. They didn't want to admit that if the baptism of John was from God, well, they couldn't say, you know, well, why didn't you obey him? They had to justify their disobedience. And if they said it was from men, well, they feared the people again. And they would have said, well, if we say that, then the people are going to do us, cause us grief. So we just can't answer. Again, justifying the self. Let's look one more set of scriptures on this particular point in Luke chapter 10. Luke chapter 10, we'll start in verse 25. Luke 10, verse 25. Self-justification, we all do it on occasions. We all catch ourselves on occasion. And that's what we need to be looking at now as we go through these, to think about and to overcome these areas. Luke chapter 10, starting in verse 25. A particular lawyer, an expert in the law, was trying to trip up Jesus Christ by asking him these questions. Luke chapter 10, verse 25. And behold, a certain lawyer stood up and tested him, saying, teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life? That's a good question. And he said to him, what is written in the law, and what is your reading of it? So he answered and said, you shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, and with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself. And he said to him, you have answered rightly. Do this, and you will live. Verse 29, but he, wanting to justify himself, said to Jesus, and who is my neighbor? Who is my neighbor? You know, Christ said to the lawyer, he said, you got to the heart of the matter. You understand what was God's law, and the intent was God's law was for. But the man did not want to follow it, did he? He did not want to follow it. He wanted to be able to continue to have wrong attitudes towards others he did not like. That's why he asked the question, well, who's my neighbor? Remember, the Jews did not like the Samaritans. And he didn't want to express the love towards the Samaritans in any way. And he was not willing to make a change. Instead, he justified by asking, who is my neighbor? Rather than saying, yes, you're right, and doing it. And as you read the rest of the Good Samaritan, the parable Jesus gave after that to show who his neighbor was. So let's go to point number three. Point number three, self-centered. Self-centered. It's all about me. How many times we hear people say that? It's all about me. Look at me in my 15 minutes of fame. Look what, you know, look what Mrs. Pelosi did at the end of the speech when she ripped the paper. All about me. Bring attention to me. And that's a very minor compared to everything else that was going on, but that just made me think about that. It's all about me. And I think one of the big examples we have in our society today is selfies. That when that came in, hey, get you a selfie stick, take your picture, put it up on social media, show everybody how what a wonderful time you have or where you've been or what you're doing. Again, what is it? Look at me. Look at me. And from time to time, we will read and we will hear where someone does this on an edge of a cliff, on a side of a mountain, they fall off and kill themselves. You've seen that in the news several times, but they got a great photo. And if the camera survives, which they do on occasion, what a great picture they got as they were falling off. It's all about me. It's all about me. 2 Timothy chapter 3. 2 Timothy chapter 3, starting in verse 1. This society is going more and more and more that way. And we know that because the farther you get away from God's laws and God's way of life, it has to be about me. Because that's what it's all about. Because we're selfish. Again, human nature. We have to make sure that as this is going on, you and I are not caught up in this same attitude. We really have to be careful. 2 Timothy chapter 3, starting in verse 1. Paul warns us here, the days are coming, the end time. And this is what self-centeredness will just get worse and worse. But know this, that in the last day, perilous times will come. Men will be lovers of themselves, lovers of money, boasters, proud, blasphemers, disobedient to parents, unthankful, unholy, unloving, unforgiving, slanderers, without self-control, brutal, despisers of good, traitors, headstrong, haughty, lovers of pleasure rather than lovers of God, having a form of godliness but denying its power. From such, turn away. Doesn't that really describe our society as it's going right now? Especially, though, what you hear in the news. Lovers of self. Unthankful. No self-control. Say whatever they want to say. Do whatever they want to do. Despisers of those who do good. Lovers of pleasure more than lovers of God. The New Living Translation says, quote, people will love only themselves and their money. Isn't that what we see as a trend? And I realize that the entire nation, the entire world is not doing it 100%. But more and more and more people are going that way. Again, once you take the way laws of God away, all you have is human judgments. Romans chapter 2. Romans chapter 2. We will read verses 8 through 11. Romans chapter 2, verses 8 through 11. Here Paul, earlier in the chapter, was talking about those who were condemning others of sin as they themselves were committing the exact same sin. Romans chapter 2, starting in verse 8. But those who are self-seeking and do not obey the truth, but obey unrighteousness, indignation and wrath, tribulation and anguish on every soul of man who does evil, of the Jew first, but also of the Greek. But glory and honor and peace to everyone who works what is good, to the Jew first and also to the Greek, for there is no partiality with God. Verse 8 very plainly says, those who are self-seeking, seeking only for self, will have the wrath of God on them for their unrighteousness. I like to read verse 8 from the New Living Translation. Quote, but he will pour out his wrath on those who live for themselves, who refuse to obey the truth, instead live lives of wickedness. And we know that is the case. Society is going that way. It's all about me. My needs, my concerns, all about me. But God says it doesn't matter in verse 11. God is not partial. It doesn't matter whether you're a Jew or a Gentile, a Christian or non-Christian. God is not, he doesn't show partiality. We all have to make sure we're doing what's right. And you and I know that as we live in this society, and we know it, that this world does affect us. We know it does affect us. We know it does. We know it rubs off on us if we're not careful. We have to examine ourselves, take that time to look, to see. Is something rubbing off on us that shouldn't be? Because we know we're going to Mark chapter 9, starting verse 33, we know in the gospel accounts that the disciples had that same problem. Mark chapter 9, verse 33. You know, not long after Jesus Christ had told the disciples how he was going to suffer, they had an argument about them between themselves. Mark chapter 9, starting in verse 33. Back in 31, he talks about how he'd be betrayed and condemned and killed. Verse 33. And when he came to Capernaum, and when he was in the house, he asked him, "What was it that you disputed among yourselves on the road?" But they kept silent, for on the road they had disputed among themselves, what? Who would be the greatest? And he sat down and called the 12 and said to them, "If anyone desires to be first, he shall be last of all and servant of all." What were they arguing about? Again, these were the disciples of Jesus Christ. What were they arguing about? Again, it's all about me. Who's going to be number one? Who's going to be the greatest? Well, it might be me because I'm a great speaker. It might be me because I have compassion. But they were arguing about who would be number one. Chapter 10 here in Mark, starting in verse 35. And these are the disciples of Jesus Christ, which we are as well. We can see it can affect you and I as well. Mark chapter 10, starting in verse 35. Then James and John, the sons of Zebedee, came to him, saying, "Teacher, we want you to do for us whatever we ask." It's kind of a loaded question there, isn't it? And he said to them, "What do you want me to do for you?" And they said to him, "Grant us that we may sit, one on your right hand and the other on your left hand, in your glory." But Jesus said to them, "You do not know what you ask. Are you able to drink the cup which I drink, and be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with?" And they said to him, "We are able." So Jesus said to them, "You will indeed drink the cup that I drink, and with the baptism that I am baptized, you will be baptized. But to sit on my right hand or on my left hand is not mine to give, but is for those whom it is prepared." And when the 10 heard it, they became greatly displeased with James and John. Both James and John, what did they want? They want to be on the top, one on the right hand, one on the left hand. I think actually verse 41 is pretty funny if you think about it. It's pretty funny. The other disciples were displeased. Why were they displeased? I didn't think of it first. Why didn't I think of that? They were displeased that they didn't get to be first, thinking about that. Again, that carnal human nature wanting to be number one. And you and I, again, we have to make sure that that's not the case. Third John, it can affect those in the church as well, as it did here in Third John. We'll read verses 9 and 10. We have an example of that. A certain man in charge of the church area, evidently, as we read, he loved being number one. 3 John, starting in verse 9. "I wrote to the church, but Diotrephes, who loves to have the preeminence among them, did not receive us. Therefore, if I come, I will call to mind his deeds which he does, prating against us with malicious words. And not content with that, he himself does not receive the brethren, and forbid those who wish to, putting them out of the church." This man was putting people out of the church who would not do what he wanted. The phrase here is interesting, quote, "love to have preeminence." It's only used one time in the New Testament. Strong's number G5383, and it means to strive to be first or to be fond of being first. Loving being number one. It's all about me. It's something we have to be very careful with. My guess, probably if this gentleman was alive now, he'd have lots of selfies with everybody, wouldn't he? He'd be talking about putting it up on social media, what a great guy he was. The problem existed then, and the problem exists now with us if we're not careful. You and I have to spend this time looking at ourselves to make sure and examine our motivation of why we do things. Let's go to point number four. Point number four. Self-willed. Self-willed. You know, there's a difference between determination and self-will. It takes determination to endure the trials of this life, does it not? And we know that those who endure this trials of this life, that we will be saved and will inherit all things. But self-willed is a different attitude. It's the attitude of my way or the highway. We've all heard that. You remember the song Frank Sinatra sang? He released it back in 1969. The title of the song was what? I Did It My Way. I did it my way. No matter what everybody else wanted to do, I did it my way. That didn't start with Frank Sinatra by any means. That actually started with Adam and Eve, didn't it? If you think about it. I will do it my way, no ever. Remember, again, two trees in the garden, right? They could have partaken of either tree. But they chose to partake of the tree of knowledge of good and evil. They could have eaten of the tree of life. It was there. There was no reason that they couldn't have partaken of it. But they chose not to eat it. Because if you ate of the tree of life, you had to admit you don't know the best way to live. You have to be willing to say to God, you know what's right, you know what's wrong, I don't. Therefore, because I know how much you love me, I will listen and follow you. But man has decided instead to go his own way, has he not? And we've all done that. I've done it. I've done things that my way. And we all know that. It's very common for all of us. Man decided to go his own way. He said, I'll decide. I'll decide what's right. I'll decide what's wrong. And I'll decide what's the best course of action for me as an individual. And we can see what's happened in our society because of that, can't we? This person chooses this way. This person chooses that way. Confusion, problems, difficulties. The Israelites, as we know, were very self-willed. God called them stiff-necked many different times. The phrase stiff-necked is Strong's number 87185, and it has several meanings, and none of the meanings are good. Meanings such as cruel, grievous, hard-hearted, obstinate, stubborn. That was just a few. There were a lot more words when it comes to describing what stiff-necked meant. Israelites, it doesn't matter whether you're Israelite or the Gentiles or any person. That is the attitude that mankind has. I'm going to do it my way. That's why eventually God has to bring this world to its knees to finally make mankind realize our way, his way, man's way on his own will not ever work. Remember back in Numbers 13 and 14 how the 12 spies were sent. We know the story. 10 of the spies gave a bad report, stirred up the people. They were so close to being in the promised land. They just had to basically go over the mountains to make it into the promised land. But they refused. Instead, they wanted to do what? They want to go back to Egypt. And I always thought about that. You want to go back to Egypt to the slavery? Seriously? When you're that close to being free? But they wanted it their way. In fact, they blame Moses for bringing them out in the wilderness to kill them, remember? He brought us out to kill our children. And then when God says, okay, I've had enough. 40 years of wandering because of this. What did the Israelites say? We're sorry. We shouldn't have done it. Okay. Oh, no, absolutely not. They tried to go up anyway, didn't they? They were going to do it their way. Didn't really matter. And, of course, we know what happened. Many of the people were killed. With the exception of Joshua and Caleb, they did not listen to God and his will. They wanted it their way. Let's go to 1 Kings chapter 12. 1 Kings chapter 12. The nation that God chose continued as his model nation. And they continued to do these things their way. 1 Kings chapter 12. We'll start in verse 4. In 1 Kings 12 verse 4, Solomon had died. Solomon had died and his son had started to reign. 1 Kings chapter 12. And Israel was tired of being overtaxed and overburdened, and they wanted some relief. So Rehoboam decided to ask some questions before he made the decision. So let's start in verse 4. Jeroboam come before him in verse 4. He says, your father made our yoke heavy. Now therefore lighten the burdensome service of your father and his heavy yoke, which he has put on us, and we will serve you. And he said to them, depart for 3 days and come back to me. And the people departed. Then the king Rehoboam consulted the elders who stood before his father Solomon while he still lived and said, how do you advise me to answer these people? I mean, he did the right thing. He started to ask for advice. They spoke to him saying, if you'll be a servant to these people today and serve them and answer them and speak good words to them, they will be your servants forever. But he rejected the advice that the elders had given him and consulted with the young men who'd grown up with him and stood before him. And he said to them, what advice do you give? How should we answer this people who have spoken to me, saying, lighten the yoke which your father has put on us? And the young men who had grown up with him spoke to him, saying, thus you should speak to this people who've spoken to you, saying, your father made our yoke heavy, but you make it lighter on us. Thus you shall say to them, my little finger shall be thicker than my father's waist. Whereas my father put a heavy yoke on you, I will add to your yoke. My father chastised you with whips, but I will chastise you with scourges. And he took the advice of the younger people to say that. It just amazes me. And he said, you know, you think dad was bad? Just wait till I get a hold of you. You think dad overtaxed you? Just wait till I'm done with you. Verse 15. So the king would not listen to the people, for the turn of the events was from the Lord, which he might fulfill his word, which the Lord had spoken by Ahijah to Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. When his people, all the Israel, saw the king had not listened to him, the people answered to the king, says, what share do we have in David? We have no inheritance, son of Jesse. To your tents, O Jerusalem. Now see to your own house, O David. So they departed. That was what they did. Instead of him listening, Rehoboam listening and doing it the right way, he did it his way. He took the advice of those who were young like him. But what about Jeroboam? Jeroboam, did he follow God's way or did he choose to do his own way? Because he went to tuck the 10 tribes with him. When you think about Jeroboam, it does make you wonder. He told him why he was giving him the 10 tribes. But again, Jeroboam did the same thing. He refused to listen. Verse 27. Verse 26, and Jeroboam said in his heart, now the kingdom may return to the house of David. For if these people go up to offer sacrifices in the house of the Lord at Jerusalem, then the heart of this people will turn back to their Lord, Rehoboam, the king of Judah. And they will kill me and go back to Rehoboam, king of Judah. Therefore the king asked advice, and he made 2 calves of gold and said to the people, it's too much for you to go up to Jerusalem. Here are your gods, O Israel, which brought you up from the land of Egypt. It's really funny that after all that time, what did he make his idols again? 2 calves, golden calves. And he set one up in Bethel, and the other he put in Dan. This thing became a sin, for the people went to worship before the one as far as Dan. And he made shrines on the high places, and made priests from every class of people who were not of the sons of Levi. And Jeroboam ordained a feast on the 15th day of the 8th month, like the feast that was in Judah, and offered sacrifices on the altars. He did this in Bethel, sacrificing to the calves that he'd made. And at Bethel he installed the priests of the high places which he had made. He did an absolutely terrible thing. Again, he chose to go his way, not the way that God would want him to do. And the 10 tribes of Israel never recovered from this sin. They never recovered from it. Go to Daniel chapter 4. Daniel chapter 4. And read start in verse 30. King Nebuchadnezzar, as you remember, he had a problem. He liked doing things his way too. In fact, he thought maybe just a little too highly of himself. He thought that everything he had, everything that was around him, was because he was so great. And because of his great power. Daniel chapter 4. Starting in verse 30. And the king spoke, saying, is this not great Babylon that I have built for a royal dwelling by my mighty power and for the honor of my majesty? He was a little puffed up there. While the word was still in the king's mouth, a voice fell from heaven, King Nebuchadnezzar, to you it is spoken. The kingdom has departed from you, and they shall drive you from men, and your dwelling shall be with the beast of the field. And they shall make you eat grass like oxen, and seven times shall pass over you until you know the Most High rules in the kingdom of men and gives it to whomever he chooses. That very hour the word was fulfilled concerning Nebuchadnezzar. He was driven from men and ate grass like oxen. His body was wet with the dew of heaven until his hair had grown like eagle's feathers and his nails like bird's claws. Verse 34. And at the end of the time, I, Nebuchadnezzar, lifted up my eyes to heaven, and my understanding returned to me, and I blessed the Most High, and I praised and honored him who lives forever. For his dominion is an everlasting dominion, and his kingdom is from generation to generation, and all the inhabitants of the earth are reputed as nothing. He does according to his will in the army of heavens. And among the inhabitants of the earth, no one can restrain his hand, and no one can say, what have you done? King Nebuchadnezzar is one of the few that actually learned that God does according to his will. All of a man's will amounts to nothing compared to what God wants. So we examine ourselves in this life. What do we see as we look at ourselves? Does our will win out most of the time? Or does God's will win out most of the time in our life? It's something you and I have to look at. Only you can say. But it's a good time to look and ask ourselves, are we wanting to do God's will, or is it our own self-will? Let's go to point number five. Point number five, self-deception. Self-deception. The last point is very difficult. It's not as difficult to do. It's difficult to see. It's so easy to deceive ourselves, isn't it? It's so easy to deceive ourselves. It's so easy to see that little spot in our brother's eye, and we have this great big log hanging out our own eye. It's just so easy to see. Because if you think about it, you listen to the news, you listen to little politics. Oh, this person does this, and this person does that. Meantime, they're doing the exact same thing. You're like, you're just being a hypocrite. Look at yourself. But again, it's self-deception. Jeremiah 17. Jeremiah 17, verse 9. You know, when we examine this aspect of ourself, we have to remember what Jeremiah says. Jeremiah 17, verse 9. Jeremiah tells us what God thinks of our hearts. And the word for use heart, it talks about the inner man. The inner mind, the inner self. If you ask someone, is the heart of man good? What will they tell you? They'll say, well, for the most part, the heart of man is good. Look at all the good things that man does. If you ask someone personally, do you think your heart, your inner being, what you believe is good? And most people will say, yes, for the most part. But that's not what God says about our heart, is it? Jeremiah 17, verse 9. The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Who can know it? I, the Lord, search the heart. I test the mind, even to give every man according to his ways, according to the fruit of his doings. The NIV puts verse 9 this way, quote, the heart is deceitful above all things and beyond cure. Who can understand it? The heart is incurably sick. The word deceitful means fraudulent, crooked, deceitful, polluted. That's the carnal heart that you and I still have today. That's why it's so easy for us to deceive ourselves. But we can't fool God, as we read in verse 10. God says he searches out, he tests the heart, and he rewards according to what's there. You know, I remember watching this has been years and years ago, a certain talent scene. It might have been America's Got Talent. I saw a little section of her, whatever, I don't know, one of those. And this woman, this particular girl, she was singing. And she was horrible. She's like cats being, you know, up in a vacuum cleaner or something. She was horrible. Pretty graphic, I understand, but she was terrible. But when she was finished, all her friends and all her family come up and gave her hugs. Oh, you are awesome. Now, the judges didn't believe that by any means. And they didn't agree with that conclusion. You know, her friends and her family really did her great disservice, didn't they? Because they told her how great she was. And unfortunately, she believed it. She thought that, oh, she did a fantastic job and she was robbed. That's that self-deception. Galatians chapter 6. Galatians chapter 6. Read verses 7 through 8. This is sometimes that we deceive ourselves. Deceiving ourselves thinking that this law doesn't always apply to us. Doesn't always apply to us. It's the law of sowing and reaping. Galatians chapter 6, starting in verse 7. Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. For whatever a man sows, he will also reap. For he who sows to the flesh will of the flesh reap corruption. But he who sows to the Spirit will of the Spirit reap everlasting life. The New Living Translation puts verse 7 this way. I like the way they put it. Don't be misled. You cannot mock the justice of God. You will always harvest what you plant. Think about that. You will always harvest what you plant. And we know that to be true, don't we? When's the last time you planted some pinto beans and corn came up? When's the last time you planted cucumbers and you had tomatoes? Well, you say that's crazy. Come on. Everybody knows that. You know, you can't plant the seeds and expect something else to come up, can you? But when it comes to spiritual seeds, we tend to look at it a little bit differently, don't we? Can you plant rudeness and expect to grow kindness? Can you plant pride and arrogance and expect to reap compassion and love? Can you treat others like dirt and expect them to deeply love you? We reap what we sow. And in this world especially, they don't necessarily believe that, do they? This part of the self-deception is really quite common. There's a disconnect between what we do and what we expect from others. We all know people who sow the seeds of the flesh through anger, through bitterness, through whatever the case may be, and they don't expect to reap the results that they get. The people don't want to be around them. People don't want to be near them. Sometimes it seems like they can never put two and two together and understand what you're sowing, you're going to reap. But on the other hand, you and I have seen those who sow kindness and compassion, and you've seen them reap the blessings from that. We do receive what we plant. We reap what we sow. And it doesn't matter whether you're in the church. It doesn't matter if you're out of the church. That is a law of God, and we all see it around us. Whether it's family members, whether it's neighbors, co-workers, whether it's politicians on TV, we reap what we sow. So we have to ask ourselves, what are you and I sowing in this life? Are we sowing to the flesh, the selfish flesh? Are we sowing to the Spirit? You know how we can know? What's the fruit? What's the fruit? Are we sowing to things, again, love and compassion to others, forgiveness and mercy? We can tell by the fruits in which we receive. James chapter 1. James chapter 1. We read verses 22 through 25. Another way we deceive ourselves is self-deception. James talks about here in James chapter 1, verse 22. James just tells us we shouldn't deceive ourselves by only listening and not doing. James chapter 1, verse 22. Be doers of the word and not hearers only, deceiving yourselves. For if anyone is a hearer of the word and not a doer, he's like a man observing his natural face in a mirror. For he observes himself and goes away and immediately forgets what kind of man he was. But he who looks into the perfect law of liberty and continues in it and is not a forgetful hearer, but a doer of the work, this one will be blessed in what he does. If we only hear and don't actually do anything, it's like us looking in the mirror and we've got this mud all over our face. We see it there. We just walk away, don't do anything, rather than taking the time to clean it off. That's the way it's easy to deceive ourselves, again, by hearing only and not doing what we are told. So then, as we do examine ourselves, when you see these problems, and we all can see problems, what do we do? What do you and I do? Is there an antidote for us that will help us to overcome this selfish nature of ours? Go into Philippians chapter 2. One simple solution that will cure this selfishness. There's one thing that you and I can do, Philippians chapter 2, starting in verse 5, that will help us to overcome this selfish nature of ours. Philippians chapter 2, verse 5. As we read these scriptures and we think about the Passover, we need to consider what these verses say. Philippians chapter 2, verse 5. Let this mind be in you, which is also in Christ Jesus, who, being in the form of God, did not consider it robbery to be equal with God, but made himself of no reputation, taking the form of a bondservant and coming in the likeness of men, and being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient to the point of the cross, point of death, even the death of the cross. What was the mind of Jesus Christ? The word mind translated is Strong's number G5426, and it means to exercise a mind, to entertain, to have opinions. How did Jesus Christ exercise his mind? Verse 8, it says, he humbled himself to the point of death. What did he do? He put the Father's will above his own self-will, didn't he? He humbly submitted to God. Jesus Christ is a perfect example of humility. Putting on that humility as Christ has is how you and I can overcome. And I really think I've seen so much, and you all have over the years. I think the biggest antidote to a lot of the trouble we have in a church, whatever the case may be, is humility. You've seen difficulties and problems. People get upset. People, you know, want to break off, start their own. Just think, if we all were humble as Jesus Christ, we wouldn't care who got the glory, would we? We wouldn't care any of that. We'd be concerned for one another. We wouldn't have the pride. We wouldn't have the selfishness that comes by doing our own thing. The only way we can get rid of self-centeredness, self-righteousness, self-justification, self-will, and self-deception is that we humble ourselves before God. And this is the time, as we're looking at the Passover, to be thinking about it, examining ourselves. You know, we know the self is there. You know, Romans 7, Paul talks about the great struggle that he had. And we think, well, if Paul had that great struggle, I'm probably going to have that great struggle too on occasion, aren't I? All of us are going to have. But we also know that we have the very mind of God in us. John 14:23, Jesus Christ, what did he say? He said, him and the Father come, make their dwelling in us. So we have that power, that ability to overcome this self. Yeah, knowing and thinking about all that Jesus Christ and God the Father has done for you and me, it should make us not only thankful, but it should humble us as we prepare ourselves for the Passover. We have to have the same attitude that David had. And if you look in the Psalms, you'll see many times David asked him, what did he say? He said, test me, try me, examine me. Why did he do that? Why did David want that? Because he wanted to get rid of that dross, that so that the silver, again, would be pure. He wanted to get rid of that sin out of his life, just like you and I want to do the same. I'm going to conclude today by just reading one of these verses that David talked about that. I'm going to finish by quoting Psalms chapter 26 and verse 2, where David said, "Examine me, O Lord, and prove me. Try my mind and my heart." You know, brethren, now is the time. Passover's a couple months away. Now is the time for us to spend some time examining the self.